All right, so today we have Matt Nunagawa joining. Thank you for taking the time. Thanks for joining and talking about your career path and engineering growth and career pathing in your organization. So why don't you start with your career story first?
Yeah, so I've been coding for a very long time, basically since I was around 5 years old, roughly. Somewhere in the early 80s, my mother decided that computers were kind of a big thing, and she was going to learn how to program so that she could teach me how to program as a small child, and sent me to, you know, the nascent equivalent of like kids coding classes. Even in the early 80s, apparently these were a thing and whatnot. So, you know, I don't literally can't remember a time in my life where I wasn't programming in some way, shape, or form and whatnot. So, and it's something I love to do and I enjoy, but it definitely... looking at the career arc is interesting because, you know, programming is one of those things that, you know, was part of kind of like a hobby and then kind of like a, you know, part of a curriculum, you know, going through college and whatnot. Even as an electrical engineer, which was my actual degree, you know, I did a lot of programming and a lot of computer systems studies as electives as part of that, right? My early career was actually in the semiconductor industry, but I did a lot of embedded programming, you know, at that time. So it's always been kind of either core or tangential to what I did as kind of I went through these things, right? And then of course coming to Silicon Valley, it's all, you know, web stuff and mobile. My early career in Silicon Valley was primarily based on my mobile expertise back when there weren't a lot of mobile experts and whatnot, and primarily as a consultant, right? Which is a strange way, because as a consultant you don't normally get those kinds of career development. You don't get, you know, they don't expense your books and you know, right, they don't send you to training classes or conferences. You have to foot your own bill for
this. They're not paying you to learn while you're there.
Absolutely, right. And I did. I spent a lot of money on things like, you know, early WWDC class conference tickets and whatnot and things like that. And it was very fascinating because the notion of growth as a consultant is completely up to you, right? And so there's a degree of difficulty and independence there, some of which I did all right, some of which, you know, I may have slacked and whatnot, but it does come down to some degree as an independent consultant, your own curiosity and drive and initiative and discipline. And I don't consider myself a very disciplined person, but when it comes to learning, it was just frankly, the love of learning overcame some of my inherent laziness, say, and you know, and whatnot, and that kind of worked out for me. Now, when I stopped consulting, kind of temporarily to work at a startup as the first employee, is kind of where the engineering management arc kind of came into shape, right? I was the first employee at a startup that. For whatever reason, somewhat fortunately, went into hypergrowth mode very rapidly. So I came in as the first employee. So there was the four co-founders and myself. By the time I left, you know, 3.5 years later or so, you know, the company was nearly 300 people, and I had grown the engineering team to nearly 50 engineers, right? Hiring the good majority of them and whatnot. So, and that's kind of where my management chops kind of came into play. So I had a wonderful mentor at the time as well that helped me out. Made a lot of mistakes. You know, hired managers, you know, grew managers, grew people's careers, grew my own career, those kinds of things. And it's been kind of more about management than code ever since then. These days I've actually returned to consulting and do a lot of consulting in terms of how to hire engineers and manage engineers. And that's also been working out for me, right? It's different than technical consulting as like a developer, right? Because, you know, technologies come and go, you know, mobile was hot and, you know, now machine learning and other places are hot. You know, Kubernetes is a thing that didn't exist, you know, back when I was doing backends a long time ago and whatnot. You know, different kinds of architectures and patterns and languages, you know, that kind of come and go, but, they're always going to need managers, right? You know, hiring engineers and managers never goes out of style, which is something I've kind of learned and realized recently.
Okay, so that's quite a bit of growth at one place. So you're saying that you started out as an early stage employee, built that org up to 50 engineers and so forth. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
So some of the stuff you're doing at such a small scale, right? Like that changed over time. Like how did that jump work for you when you say had one team to like managing and hiring out managers, et cetera? What were some of the skills that you had to learn that you may not have had before?
Gosh, the big one was hiring. I actually remember a day, I was about a year in and I had been doing a combination of of coding and management and architecture and hiring. And, you know, I had about maybe 10, 15 engineers, you know, low teens kind of thing. And it occurred to me, oh, if I don't have 30 engineers, we're not going to ship this, you know, on time, and the company could fail. And then it occurred to me that if I'm short 15 engineers, right, there's no amount of work I as an individual could do, right? You know, I, you know, say I'm an amazing engineer, which I may or may not be. And I did the work of two people, and then I add nights and weekends and I do the work of three people, right? You know, that's still not going to get me anywhere near what I need, right? And the only way to overcome that gap was to stop coding and to focus on hiring almost full time, which I ended up doing, right? I spent an entire year hiring. I got the team to like 25, 26, somewhere like there. So nearly the 30 we needed, and more than enough to get us to kind of the MVP we needed to get out the door, excuse me, for our first launch. And I hired, and in the first recruiter in the company, for example, reported to me. I talked to all kinds of people. I hired recruiters without knowing how to hire recruiters, and I talked to people and you know, found advisors and mentors. I talked to, you know, I reached out through the co-founders and their investor networks to you know, talk to people who have been recruiting for 20 years and kind of get their expertise. Right, I did a tremendous amount of reading, and just taking a lot of notes. I've got something like 40 or 50 pages of notes on the things I learned in those first couple of years and whatnot. And you know, that's on top of hundreds of you know, actual individual interviews with engineers. My record to this day is about 13 phone screens in one day, I believe, which was exhausting.
You've got recovered on that.
Yeah, it's I haven't found people who have bested me yet there. That was quite the day and whatnot. But you know, at the end of it, I found, frankly, that a lot of how companies hire, a lot of common practices in engineering hiring are actually bunk, right? They're actually not all that great. They're common, but doesn't mean they're amazing. And just thinking about how to hire, you know, from an engineering perspective, like what are the bottlenecks? What are the metrics? What are the things that really matter? And what are how are the ways that I reduce false negatives and false positives? You know, really, I felt like I was being effective, you know, especially coming from an engineering background, when, you know, in that role. If that made sense. Yeah. And I guess back to your original question, sorry, is the notion that as a manager, it's not about the work you do anymore, but it's about the work other people do, and then the people you bring in and the work that they do, right? And it's just that realization, oh, I have to stop coding. And that was weird. And it was like kind of shocking, because again, I'd been coding since the age of five, right? And it is just something that, oh, I no longer am in charge of this repo. I've got to let someone else, you know, do the code and get all the glory and things like that, right? Which some days I was glad to do, you know, because you can only make so many login screens over the course of a career and whatnot.
Right. Yeah. Excellent. So along the way, you know, you worked a lot with talent. I have too as well. And I've seen it be a very important draw to offer your growth programs or your examples of what you're doing as a company. You know, it's not even just about attracting talent. It's also about retaining them too, and mm-hmm. making sure through the long haul that they stay well engaged. We often call it enrichment, right? Like mm-hmm. how are you enriching the careers with the environment you have, with what you're doing? Maybe do you have any good examples of how, you know, you could get a double win, you know, where someone's growing and they're doing something else, and multiplier effects, things like that.
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, to your point about growth and talent is that, I can't remember who it was, but there was a blog post at some point that when you're hiring engineers, like you're not buying, you're selling, right? And that's a very astute observation that I wish I had come up with. And building on that, the number one thing you can often sell is growth, right? You know, assuming you've got, you know, things like comp, you know, that you're at least reasonably competitive in other areas and whatnot. And when you're able to sell growth and sell growth effectively, I think it really does change the math for you. Your question about, you know, what are the things you can do with growth that really have these multiplier effects is, I think you can actually tie growth to your actual engineering culture. Mm-hmm. When I'm with a company, right, I flat out just tell people like mastery is part of your job. Like I expect everyone in this company to get better at something, right? And usually for engineers, this is tech skills, but it doesn't have to be tech skills. You don't have to get, you know, much better at Go or architecture or iOS or whatever. It could be public speaking or writing or you know, presentations and things like that. You know, it could be, you know, giving and receiving feedback. It could be, you know, improv, right? There's a lot of different ways to get better at being an engineer that don't necessarily involve tech. Now, most of them are going to involve tech. I do expect you to be embarrassed of your code from 6 months ago to look at the architecture you designed and or a design document you wrote a year ago and just say, what was I thinking, right? That's normal and good. And it's a sure sign that you are growing, right? It does get harder, right? You know, when you're at that senior level and you know, it's the promotions come less often, right? It's much harder to go from senior to principal and or senior to staff and staff to principal than it is to go from Eng 1 to Eng 2 or Eng 2 to Eng 3, for example, right? So the opportunities are more difficult. You have to impact a larger amount of people or a larger surface area of product or a larger chunk of the business outcomes, right? You know, going up the chain, right? But you have to be able to do this, right? One thing that I've been very successful, again, trying to get back to your original question of what are the multipliers, is by mandating growth, right, as a function of your success, right? What you're really doing is saying that not only do I expect you to grow, but I expect you to grow the people around you, right? I don't let people become senior engineers if they don't have the ability to teach or mentor others, right? You have to see evidence of this before you get that title, right? You don't get to become a principal or a staff engineer unless you are significantly improving the efficacy or efficiency or of the people around you or some aspect or a major aspect of the business outcomes in some way, shape, or form, right?
Right.
You know, I am tying your personal growth to the titles you get and the titles you achieve over the course of a career. Now, I'm also here to support you, meaning that the things I do, right? I'll send you to the training. I'll send you to the classes. I'll go over your writing samples, right? We'll figure out what it takes to for you to learn these, you know, esoteric architecture or you know, not often used algorithms or whatever it takes, right? You know, these are the things I'm going to set you up. Like, if I'm not setting you up for success, then I'm not doing growth very well, for example. But the idea is that for me, like, it starts with just mandating that growth is something I expect, and it's just a very natural part of the engineers that I work with.
Yeah. So how are you checking in? How are you making sure it's happening? How do you measure it?
There's a lot of different ways, right? You know, sometimes it's just, you can actually talk to the person, right? For the senior and the manager, the engineering managers, right? You know, sometimes it's a function of how much, you know, how much impact you have on the product or how many people you directly support or manage. For the early people, right, it is, you can actually do things very mechanical, very objective with, days your PRs are open and amount of comments and, you know, and right, back and forth right. and amount of revisions, right? You know, when I'm talking about someone straight out of college or, you know, less than call it 4 or 5 years of experience, that there are very mechanical objective metrics that you can put in place, just pulling it straight out of, you know, like the GitHub API or something like that. Right. And whatnot.
Are you saying you're doing that with growth as well? Or are you using that technique to see what their team performance might be like, et cetera?
Well, think of it this way, right? If you're out of college, right, I expect your PRs to have a lot of comments and a lot of back and forth, and it takes you a longer time. Like they're open for longer before you get to looks good to me, right? LGTM. And then I expect those metrics to go down over time, assuming you're growing, right? Assuming you're getting the right mentorship, assuming that you're starting to, your code quality goes up and your the people around you are helping you out and you're absorbing the lessons, you know, either directly or through osmosis, you know, that the people around you are trying to, you know, say. When they say, oh, why don't you refactor this way? They're not saying your code is lousy. They're saying that there is some key reason, right, why doing it this other way is better for the product or the team or the business or the code health or the code smells or whatever, right? And have you absorbed those lessons, or are those the need for our teammates to be explicit about that going down over time?
I see now. I see your point. So you're saying that shows up pretty easily in metrics, the earlier stage the candidate is.
Yeah.
So how do you do that in maybe you know, later stage folks, how do you keep track of this growth? Or do you? I mean, some people don't. Some people use software. You know, those are the two extremes, I guess. You know,
I think, again, the later stages is tougher. I think it is, you're relying on a lot less objective measures, such as, you know, lines of code or things like that, right? You're doing a lot more around, you know, 360 and peer review, right? You have things like, you find phrases, right, and questions, right? You know, either informally around your peers and you know, and you know, the people around you and across the organization of how valuable this is. You know, it's questions like, you know, if so-and-so is thinking about leaving, right, how likely or how interested would you want to be in working with this person? If 5 years from now they reached out to you and said, would you like to work with me again? What would you say, right? And then hear things like, it doesn't even matter. I would drop everything I'm doing. It doesn't matter what company, you know, it doesn't matter what, you know, industry. I would go work with this person. All the way down to, gosh, I really would. I mean, you know, things like all the way down to like, I don't see myself working with this person again. Right. And then and everything in between, like, you know, from, I would move across the country to, you know, gosh, you know, it depends. I mean, it kind of depends where, you know, if I'm, as long as I'm not at a place I really love, I probably would go work with this person again. Right. You know, which is a, you know, kind of like a 4 out of 5 on the scale. Right. You know,
right.
And you find most people are going to float around a 3, really. And if you can get, you know, and if you find people who are like, you know, in that, I would drop everything to work with you again, then you're, you know, those are the people that you measure. And you can see that these numbers actually, not so much go up, you know, but if you're talking about growth, that they are creating more of these comments, right, in that way, right? Another way to do it, right, is, you know, less, you know, far future is how much more should we be paying this person so they don't leave, right? And then you get things right. Like, you know, even if you don't know what they make, right? Say you're a peer and you may or may not know what you know, so-and-so makes. If you say, you know, if so-and-so wants a raise, you better give it to him because I don't want him leaving this company, right? You know,
yeah, like keeper test.
Yeah, exactly, right? You know, things like that. And you can do it around, you know, salary or you know, if this person leaves, how happy or unhappy would you be? You know, there's different ways of that, you know, different ways of phrasing that keeper test using different kinds of metrics, but yeah. They're you know, they're all kind of in the same neighborhood, right? And I've seen engineers that go from, you know, if so and so leaves, what would you think? And then, you know, in the early, you know, even if they're a senior career, you know, people across the org might say, oh, who's that again, right? You know, and then as they become more and more valuable, you know, especially with their peers, but, you know, possibly across the org, you know, the CEO goes, wait, are you, you're not telling me that so-and-so is a flight risk, right? Because we can't have that. Right. And then it's like, oh my gosh, now I'm in trouble, right? Now, if this person is doing so good that the CEO is telling me we're in trouble if so-and-so leaves, like, oh, okay, well, I got to do something about that then, right? you know, things like that, right? So it does get more subjective the higher you on, right? Now, the really skilled managers in certain industries and with certain companies and products, right? You can actually tie performance and growth to things like business objectives, right? You know, like one of the early metrics at Google, for example, was queries per second, right? And if you were an engineer and you were growing, you had the ability to materially affect that number, right? That was, you know, pure objective evidence of growth. Now, not everyone can, right? And it's not just queries per second. You know, there's often things, sometimes you can tie individual work to business objectives, but, you know, like an infrastructure engineer may not always be able to directly tie their work to long-term revenue numbers, for example. I mean, they kind of
They can, because where they work is in a cost center, so it's in reducing cost all the time. Yeah. And if they're good, then they may actually recoup their whole salary fully loaded just in savings all the time. I've had people do that on my ops teams. Yeah.
Yeah, there is that. But I guess I'm always careful because I'd rather have an infrastructure team that spends the money but makes every engineer twice as effective or 5 times or 10 times as effective, right, in the long run, right? So you do have to be a little bit careful, right, of drawing these direct lines from engineering work to money, because sometimes you'll get these weird. But I've definitely had the other kinds of, you know, like a compliance engineer who saves me money and talking to lawyers and stuff. You know, those people.
Right.
There's no question about that. Right. And infrastructure is one of those places where, again, you're totally right. I've had some of them come in and says, we're going to reduce your cloud spend by, you know, 40% just by doing this. I'm like, oh, please do that. Right. And other engineers come in and says, why don't we stop paying for this? And like, well, don't you understand the impact and how happy that makes 8 of my highest performing engineers when we have this tool? And they're like, no, I didn't realize that. Like, you know what I'm saying? So,
yeah.
But I hear you. I definitely hear you.
Cool. So we've been talking about growth so far. Let's let's talk about the longer path. So the career path trajectory for each individual. So, you know, people come in at a certain level in your org, and ideally you're able to show them where they're at if you have a published ladder or whatever, or ladders for both dual track or whatever. How do you make sure that their role in your org and in your team is getting them to where they want to be, basically?
So I guess a lot of different ways, right? You know, if it's a large enough company, then the published ladders and stuff makes sense because you have hopefully a fairly objective promotion rubric in place. And that can kind of give them, you know, like milestones and guidelines, right? There's still always going to be some amount of sort of subjectivity to those rubrics and whatnot. But the idea is that, you know, they have their manager, they have an internal or external or both mentor or mentors in place, right? That they have a clear set of expectations and timelines, right? I tell people, you know, as long as you're with the company and you want a promotion, right, make sure you're thinking about the promotion 12 months in advance, right? If we've got a promotion cycle come up, right, and in a month or two, that's it's too late to be saying, oh, what do I got to do to promote it? You should be talking about your promotion cycle a year from now, right? Or 6 months from now, at a minimum, to say, what do I have to prove, right? Because it's not true for every organization, but I expect people to more or less be operating at that higher level before you actually get the title. So if you're a senior engineer one and you want to be a senior engineer two, I expect you to be showing the traits, you know, across, you know, whatever 4 or 5 buckets or rubric you have in place before you actually get that title on that, you know, raise or whatever. So a month ahead, that's not enough time, right? That's you know, that's not enough time for me to reasonably evaluate, you know. Sometimes it's on me because I don't communicate, you know, this kind of thing well. Other times it's the employee. Like I'll tell you, you know what, you know, let's make sure, you know, we talk about this, right? Make sure that you put some thought into this and come back with me and let's figure out, right? Because there's always going to be a delta in terms of what an engineer thinks they're doing, you know, across the relative to the rubric and what I think the engineer is doing relative to the rubric, right? And you have to be able to shrink that delta and make sure that the both of you are in the same place. And sometimes, again, it might be on me. It might be that I have a poor understanding of what they're doing just because, you know, I don't talk to them day to day or see their impact of their work very closely for whatever reason, right? Like they're on a different floor or in a different, you know, branch office or something. Sometimes it's on them and that they have maybe unrealistic views of their impact in some way, shape or form or their code quality, right? You know, there's shrinking that delta is the trick and it's tough. And you have to have, you know, the conversations, the one-on-ones, you have to really set the expectations, right? Because, having the appropriate expectations is one of the best way for them to really march along that track appropriately. Right. And a lot of that, you know, requires, you know, explicit positive and negative feedback, right? Like you're doing great here and here, but you know what, your architecture is really suffering. Right. And I just can't give you this title because of lack of evidence or the evidence I do see isn't supporting, you know, the case that, you know, yada, yada, yada.
I think that, right. I think what you're saying, I agree with insofar as a lot of promotions end up giving someone a title for a job they're already doing.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So you're saying they're already exhibiting all of the things, just the title's the afterthought. Not really. I mean, it's important, but it's the least of the hangups. It's actually all the doing and eliciting, you know, showing that you're doing.
Yeah. It's the only way to work against the Peter principle. And really what you're doing is you're rubber stamping what everyone already believes. Right.
Yeah. That's right. As far as, you know, as you built your org and you were starting to hire managers, or did you lateral engineers from within to build your management structure, or did you hire from outside or do a little both?
A little both. I think primarily I move people internally, right? And I do this very deliberately. The one thing, and philosophically that I do, is that I don't consider going from an IC to a lead, or a lead to a manager, or a promotion or a demotion. I make it a very flexible thing, because some people think they want it and they say they want it, but they don't really want it, right? And other people are not sure they want it and they try it out and they love it. Other people really want it and they try it out and they kind of hate it. Like, oh man, I can't stand people. I don't want to, the soft skills thing isn't for me. I want to go back to just staring at a monitor or whatever. Like, you know, fine, more power to you, right? I don't celebrate, right? It's not a pay raise, right? You don't get, it's not a demotion if you go the other way, if you go back to IC, right? It's or if you go back to a lead where you're kind of doing half coding, half managing, half, you know, technical man, you know, team lead, tech lead style. It is really one of those things I'm very intentional about, right? You know, people are like, oh, I got this manager title, and everyone claps. Like, no, you have to, I don't clap. I offer sympathy. Like, you have a lot more roles and you're going to flex muscles that have been, you know, possibly laying atrophy for years, which was certainly, in my case, what happened. So the, again, starting from the notion that being a manager is not a promotion or demotion, right? Start them out as what I call a dotted line manager, right? You know, so I'll give you, say, two direct reports. I don't move the org chart, but I do kind of draw a dotted line in my head. And like, you know, this new manager is going to practice with these two new reports. And so even though they're, these two reports are on the org chart, still reporting to, say, me or some other manager who's more established, the new manager is kind of like these practice dotted lines where, you know, they go through all the ceremonies and whatnot. They get started with the one-on-ones and the mentoring and, you know, the feedback, you know, the bi-directional feedback and, you know, the radical candor and all those things, right? They are going through this thing where, you know, again, a new manager, it's about putting aside your own personal achievements and really making, prioritizing the achievements of your people, right? It's not about you excelling. It's about making your people excel. And I coach them on that. And you know, the different kinds of management training are always an option and whatnot. And you know, what I normally see is that the people who are really into it, like, you know, they just kind of do it, you know, they may or may not be a natural at it, but they start to like it. They get a sense of it, right? You know, they'll probably pick up a third or a fourth report along the way. And then the next thing I know, it's like, you know, I'm just going to move these people. I'm going to fill in these dotted lines with real lines. And yeah, you know, now you, the three or four of you actually officially report to this, you know, so-and-so, the new manager and whatnot. And they're kind of in there and whatnot. And that's kind of how I normally think of that. But again, it starts from the premise that it's neither a promotion or a demotion going in either direction.
I like that visual you gave there with the flow chart and then also the redundant load balancing nature of it, because they're not, they're never not covered, right? They have you, their official manager, but yet they're really fostering this. This is a cool way to do it, and it makes a nice safe environment, and it's like a transaction. You can roll it back if it doesn't work too.
Basically, yeah. And again, like they're gonna get all the things right over the course of this dotted line, you know, experiment, call it, you know, they'll have the one-on-ones. They may have to push someone through a promotion or a raise, right? If they're unlucky, they might have to fire someone, right? You know, and they'll get a lot of support from me on there. You know, that's the last thing I want a new manager to do, because that's like, you know, it's like, you know, just saying it's the worst. It's one of the worst parts of being a manager, but it's something that you're going to have to hopefully not excel at or do often in your career, but you know, it's something you're almost certainly going to experience at some point.
Yep. So. Cool. So Another question under this is, what do you do with folks that get stuck in a rut?
Gosh, you got a lot of options, right? Sometimes, I'll just say, I need you to just hold out and be patient for me for 6 months, right? Until we've got more options for you, because something in the business or in the company or the organization feels like it's an imminent change. You know, the very extreme example of this is, you know what? I never actually want to say this, but you may be better off in a different company in a different role, or a different role in this company, or, you know, altogether out of the industry, right? Which I never had to say yet, but you always have that option. And if I'm being truthful, you know, voting with your feet is an option as well. Some people, you know, that's kind of natural to them. Other people are like, what do you mean? Are you telling me to quit? Are you telling me you don't want me? And I'm like, no, I've been telling you that, the context of where I am today, that the given constraints, you know, we may not have options for you. Now, I think in most companies you do have options though, right? You know, modern engineering, right? You've got a front end and a back end, and you've got infrastructure and DevOps, and you've got, you know, security, and you've got mobile, and you know, you get 8 different kinds of back ends, and you've got data infrastructure, you know, with pipelines and Kafkas and Hadoops and whatnot, and everything in between, right? And then you got to wire all these together, and then there's CI/CD and everything, right? So there's a lot of different places, you know, for people to move around, right? You know, and I find that front end engineers who are stuck in a rut and want to try out back end, right? You know, I don't change their salary or their title, but you know, I will give them, I'll put them on a back-end project or team or pod or squad and you know, assign them tickets and assign them mentors as if they were, you know, not necessarily straight out of college, but you know, they're coming into a new environment or a new hire and things like that, right? I think these are always options for me, right? You know, and it could go the other way too. If I have a skilled DevOps person who wants to get into back-end or architecture or something, right? You know, I'll find ways to do that typically, right? It is, you know, it's part of being a good manager at the end of the day. If it's about moving out of tech, right, I'm happy to, you know, I've actually had a very, very skilled infrastructure and backend engineer who went into marketing and growth, right? And whatnot. And these are things that, you know, as a good manager, right? If I'm invested in your success and the ability for you to, you know, exceed and, you know, work satisfaction and happiness and things like that, right? I'd rather you be happy out of engineering in the company or possibly even out of the company than you to be miserable in engineering, you know, working for me, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely it does.
Yeah. And again, ideally we can find something that works for you, you know, in the engineering org or near it, right? You know, maybe data science is kind of one of those tangential orgs. Sometimes it's built in, sometimes it's not. But you know, there's a lot of options for people, right? You know, and sometimes they just need a break, right? You know, I've seen other people stuck in a rut, and like sometimes a 6-month sabbatical is a reasonable thing as well, right? You know, there's lots of different options. Now there's finance and tenure implications for sabbaticals and whatnot, but sometimes it's like, you know what? What if we just converted you to a consultant or something and paid you, you know, 1/5 of your salary, you check in once a week or something, you know, there's a lot of different ways. You have to be really creative and whatnot. Ironically, you can only be really, really creative in kind of these, you know, small, medium companies, right? Because the larger companies are going to have a lot more policy around it, and the smaller companies are not going to have the resources to absorb, say, a 6-month sabbatical. If I've only got 5 engineers, I can't have, you know, 1 or 2 of them going on sabbatical.
Right. Right.
The company, right. So
the same goes with interns too. The smaller companies can't sustain, you know, sustain the interns as well in the same regard. But sorry, exactly. Go ahead.
No, that's exactly it, right? I'm just saying that hopefully you have options, and the different kind of company structure and stage you're at, you can even be more and more creative, right? And like some combination of all three, you know, for example. You know.
Yeah. Let me switch gears. Let's go into my favorite round, which is the wild card round. And before I get into the questions, I will preface it with that I think you and I have in common that we've worked a lot with talent. We've spent a lot of our years, you know, hunting down the best talent. And
yeah, Rifkin was telling me some of the stuff you were doing, I don't know, 5-6 years back. It was kind of fascinating.
Yeah, we can go off the record after this. Yeah. But I'm looking for a couple of different kinds of things. In the wild card round, I'm looking for worst interview situations you've been involved with, either as an applicant or an employer. So if you got any like good, bad, or ugly stories about poor candidate experience without any details, these are always fun. Everybody has some fun stories about this stuff. Mm-hmm. Bad interviews.
Oh man. I'm trying to think of any fun ones. I'll save again.
Cringy is okay.
Cringy. All right.
It doesn't have to be fun.
Yeah. Oh, actually I have a couple actually that I can think of. All right. Yeah. And there's actually some good lessons from there as well. So, yeah.
All right, go for it.
Okay. So lots of varied stories, right? You know, I don't think I've crossed a 1,000 interviews yet, career total, but I'm certainly in the upper hundreds as far as I can tell without any metrics to back that up. You know, there's the obvious ones like the engineers who know they're doing poorly and you know, start crying and whatnot. Two awkward stories outside of crying that come to mind is one very skilled back-end DevOps, you know, infrastructure engineer who had a let's say a hygiene problem, right? And then when we let him go, it wasn't the reason we didn't hire him, but you know, there was a couple of other things. He asked for feedback. And then there, and I'm going to get back to that, but there was another engineer, who during the course of the interview, with one of the interview panels was with our company lawyer, who was a woman, and she was saying that he started talking about how he hates lawyers, and the lawyer at his last company started having, you know, an affair and a relationship in, you know, in the office with the CEO, and just kind of went off on tremendously inappropriate conversations about lawyers and workplace relationships and things like that. And that was super awkward, obviously. But the thing that ties both of those together is that both of them asked for feedback, and kind of going through the experience, you know, me being the hiring manager in both of those cases, like, oh, well, I have to have a call with this person who smelled a little wonky, and this other person who clearly, you know, doesn't understand about boundaries within an interview setting and whatnot, right? Because normally you talk about putting your best face forward in an interview. And the thing is, right, when I talked about these things with them, like, you know, oh, and by the way, there's this other thing that you probably should know, is that, you know, talking about, you know, so-and-so lawyers and CEOs is completely inappropriate, you know, in an interview. You probably want to not do that anymore. And for the other one, it's like, you know, and there's this other part about, you know, personal hygiene. I don't know how to say this, but, you know, it kind of smelled a little weird, and you probably want to, you know, put a little more effort into, you know, hygiene and whatnot, you know, especially for an interview. And in both cases, the candidates were like, oh, okay. And no one's ever told me that before. I appreciate it. Right. And they were thankful in a weird way. And one of them actually put a really positive review on Glassdoor for the interview experience, despite the fact that, you know, their behavior was a little bit, you know, cringy or whatever. And, you know, just, I think it, the lesson there, as bad as the experience was, you know, for the company side of things, that no one's ever going to tell these candidates these things. And feedback is something that if you can incorporate it in, you know, without obviously breaking any employment laws, I think can be valuable in a lot of ways for whatever that's worth. Mm-hmm. So there's that. As an applicant, I don't know, maybe I've been pretty lucky. I haven't had too many bad ones. I think, you know, the traditional applicant, you know, the traditional employee concerns, especially in Silicon Valley, it's just the really terrible LinkedIn messages I get all the time, daily, basically. It is, you know, going to an interview and not getting the job or not getting any feedback whatsoever, you know, for obvious reasons, you know, things like that. Right. So I don't have anything too terrible from the applicant side of things. Right. I've had a recruiter, that I've had working for me try and sue the company once. That was,
oh, really?
Yeah, like, and it wasn't even a very good recruiter. It's just like, oh.
Under what kind of circumstances? Is it because they thought they submitted somebody to you that you eventually hired?
No, it was the opposite. Like, they submitted a bunch of people and we didn't hire any of them. And then they tried to sue us because, oh, we gave you good candidates and you didn't want them and you're just wasting our time or something.
Oh, give
like
me
that.
A break. So, that's
right.
Talk about ensuring that you don't ever work with them again and anybody else that you talk to. Come on, that's a horrible way to run your business. Okay.
Yeah, but you know, I guess for this person, it was about, oh, you know, I sent you perfect candidates and you've rejected all of them and you're just being, you know, I don't know. It's a strange worldview that, you know, when things like that happen, it's hard for me to understand those point of views. But
right. So, what would you tell somebody who's coming straight out of schooling, maybe with a computer science degree or something like that, and they're just about to get their career started? What kind of advice might you give them?
You know, there's a lot. And what I often see is that early, you know, new engineers can actually get a lot of value. If you just Google for, you know, the kind of blog posts, you've probably seen it, you know, things I would tell myself as an old engineer talking to a younger engineer, or lessons I've learned over my first 5 years, or, you know, things that, you know, 10 lessons for, you know, new engineers, right? Or new college grads in tech or whatever, you know, and those actually have some good ones. I think a lot of it is that, you know, school and work are different, right? The patterns of communication, right? A lot of school is things are done for the benefit of the professor, you know, or the academia. That have no place, right? You know, you're going to spend a lot of time in your career, you know, mucking around with Git. So you better get good at it, you know, sooner rather than later, right? You
know, go to some hackathons, like, you know.
Right? You know, things like that, right? And it's also things like, you know, really there's no speed limit to how fast you learn or grow, right? You can spend $5 a month on some VPS through, you know, Linode or DigitalOcean and actually have this playground to learn, you know, how to install and run, you know, Ubuntu and Nginx. And
you still have Root or whatever.
Django. Yeah. Yeah. All these things. Right. You know, I mean, you know, you're going to setting up and blowing away your DNS is a good way to learn about how TTLs work and, you know, things like that. Right. So it's, especially as a young person, right? When you're not necessarily, when most people are not, I should say, most people are not necessarily tied down, but with family obligations, right? That you want to take advantage of your energy and your time, right? You know, as a young person, I had a lot of energy and time. I had not enough money, right? As an old person, I have more money, right? But, you know, time and energy are my limiting resources these days, right? I mean, I'm not rich by any means, right? But it's different, right? You know, going through a career arc and whatnot. So take advantage of the time and money you have as the resources that you're going to have excess of.
Right. And there's no excuse for not knowing stuff with all the content on YouTube. And then especially for developer engineers, Stack Overflow, right? Like there's nothing that you can't seek the answer to, even a stack trace or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of those things though. It's the unknown unknowns. Like do they know they're supposed to know about, you know, DNS, like sometimes not, right? I think I've met 10 engineers, right, that didn't know that, you know, DNS is just one of these things that magically the infrastructure team just kind of sorts out for them. You know, like if I buy a domain name, I thought GoDaddy does everything with DNS, right? You know, or, you know, things like that. Or it's like, no, you have as much power over DNS as you want, right? Or you may give that power to other people, right? But, you know, don't forget that, you know, a $15 domain name and a $5 a month VPS is really all you need, right? That's the amount of dollar investment. The rest is on you, you know, at the end of the day, you know?
Yeah.
So things like that.
One of the themes I've seen in this series, around this question for like a new grad is they say, go to a big company first and start with the smallest role. And that could even be an internship, right? Cause they can usually afford this, like as a feeder league or whatever, and try and work your way up at bigger orgs first. And at some point you're going to get to the title that you want or that you turn on. And then a lot of people will start to work at smaller and smaller companies with higher and higher and higher titles. So maybe they do a startup and now they're the only techie there, technical co-founder, et cetera. And a lot of people in this series kind of match that arc actually.
Yeah, I think so. I think starting at a big company, there's something there, but rather, the big company is going to have the infrastructure, kind of the support systems, you know, the rubrics and all this stuff in place. But I don't know that it's wrong to start at a startup either, because a startup is a place where you're wearing a lot of hats. Like the expectation is that you learn and you learn fast, and you're forced to learn. And that a startup is one of those places where you can accelerate your career growth at almost, you know, any stage of your career. You know, in the sense that, you know, in a big company at a minimum, like you can only get promoted, you know, once or twice a year, right? You know, at a startup, you know, they're going to promote you when you're ready or
right.
You know, things, as long as you have, you know, good mentors and are in a good environment and, you know, good, you know, experienced peers, right? Things like that. You never want to be like in a startup where, you know, you've got four people straight out of college, you know, trying to build a website or something like that. That sounds like a disaster. Right. But there's definitely an advantage to having both a large company and a startup experience as early as possible. Right. If for nothing else, that kind of get a sense of what you like.
I would say actually that resonates with me. That's my career path. Like I've never worked for bigger companies over a certain size. And if I did, it was because I was consulting for them. So by the time I worked with really, really, really big companies, I was not an employee there. But as far as just general advice, I thought that was kind of interesting, but you're right. Actually, there is no one single path, but
yeah, absolutely. And again, I think the other thing too is that you're going to treat data and code differently, right? You know, there are some things out there. You know, you can get really fancy that data is code and code is data or whatever. And there's aspects where that makes sense. But I think when I think of
sounds like Prologue. Go ahead.
Yeah, kind of right. But think of it this way: when startup, you know, when Twitter goes down. Right. You know, you don't lose your tweets. Right. If you lose data, that can be catastrophic. Right. If you bust your uptime SLA, that's bad, but it's not catastrophic, like losing everyone's medical records or everyone's, you know, family pictures or things like that. Right. So you're gonna have to be a little more paranoid and conservative and safe on data. That would be the only, you know, technical lesson. The rest of the things I'm going to talk about new college grads is just about, you know, basically learning how to learn and learning as fast as possible. And really understanding how to ask questions and give and get feedback are kind of the big things, right?
Words of wisdom there.
Yeah. How to take advantage of mentorship and learning opportunities, you know, things like that. You know, those are the big things, right? And again, be conservative about how you manage and model your data.
Yep. Speaking of data loss, you know, they have special grief counselors out there for people who have catastrophic data loss, like unrecoverable, you know, big data loss, et cetera.
Get out.
Yeah. And it can happen on hard drives too, but yeah, they actually have had a new field emerge just for that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing. It makes sense, but yeah, it's because, you know, grief is about loss, and it's, you know, often we think of loss as human and relationship loss, but it, you know, losing all your possessions in a fire, or losing all your data in a catastrophic incident of some kind certainly count as loss. Yeah. Gosh, I mean, one of the big things I've been thinking about lately is what are the differences between like early or mid-career engineers versus senior engineers and staff engineers, like what separates them? So I could spend a chunk of time just kind of going through that.
Yeah, go right into it. Go for it.
Yeah. I think this has driven a lot of my thoughts over the past year or so, right? When I think of an early or mid-career engineer versus, you know, a senior or a staff principal engineer, right? A lot of it, you know, comes in kind of three buckets, right? It's the things you know, right? You know, all the different tech stacks and skills and languages and tools. It's how much I trust you, you know, to take how much I trust you with the ability to execute, right? In particular, the ability to execute on your own autonomously, right? And how much you make all the things around you better, right? So the things you know is fairly straightforward, right? You know, just the more you know about, you know, common or esoteric topics is important, right? And you just kind of accumulate knowledge and experience over your career. But the trust part is interesting because you don't necessarily have to be an old engineer for me to trust you, right? It's about the reliability and resilience of the code or the components or the system you make and the defect rate, you know, the rate of new bugs and the rate of regressions, you know, and also not just the defect rate, but how the time to resolution, right? You know, how often, how fast are bugs discovered and how fast are they resolved in a lot of ways? And you know, good code and good code bases and good systems are more resilient to bugs and they're discovered faster and they're resolved earlier and easier and more rapidly, right? And it's also about, you know, when I trust you with a component, I'm implicitly trusting you to eventually align the work you do with the broader business goals, right? Meaning that it's not just that I trust you to build something, but I trust you to build something in a way that you're going to ask the right questions about, you know, kind of the short and the medium and the long-term requirements. And you're going to make sure like you're asking for this, but I think you're asking it because of you need X, Y, and Z for the business, but I think you're only going to X and Y out of this because of so-and-so, right? Or, you know, this or that, right? Here's how we achieve G. Here's how we achieve Z, you know, by tweaking, you know, what you're asking for in this way. Right? That's a staff engineer. That's a principal engineer. People who not only can I trust you to develop X, Y, and Z on your own, but that you're able to read between the lines in terms of what the company or the business is trying to pull off. And of course, there's, you know, the pure metrics of, you know, early versus mid versus senior in terms of just the size or the complexity or the riskiness or the impact of the project or the feature that you can pull off or the component or the system, right? And of course, you know, there's all the things around being able to communicate and mentor and whatnot, right? Now, that last bucket of making everything around you better, right? You know, there's mentorship aspects of that are there. It's kind of a one-to-one model, but it's also, what are the processes or automation you put in place that makes everyone around you more efficient, right? You know, that's how you don't get a 10X engineer because you do the work of 10 engineers. You get a 10X engineer because they put process and automation and tooling and code and systems and API contracts in place that make everyone around them, you know, a little more efficient. If you can make 100 engineers 10% more efficient, congratulations, you're a 10X engineer, right? You know, things like that. You know, stuff like that. So that's, you know, I want to see senior engineers, you know, investing in things, you know, putting effort into things with compounding results, right?
Yep, multiplier effects, right?
Absolutely, absolutely, right? And of course, you know, continuous learning and being open-minded and all those other things, right? You need to make the people around you more successful and having those multiplier effects, right? It's really striking to me, right? You know, if you think of, you know, even just like a daily 1% improvement, you know, that's a lot over the course of a business year, right? That's a lot. You're going to, that's how you really lap your competitors, if you could kind of find people who have that mindset at the end of the day. So
absolutely. Yeah, it's all about mindset. I mean, even down to I derived a purpose statement. Took me a little bit of time to refine it, but it's all about what I love doing is building environments where engineers have the opportunity to do the most challenging work of their lives, be challenged outside of their comfort zone, achieve potentially magnitude level growth, and be worth more in the marketplace.
Like, oh, I love it. Yeah.
While they're there and beyond, you know? So it's all about building the environments. And I really appreciate all of your perspectives here. This is a really great way to look at it. All right, Matt. Well, I want to thank you for joining today. It's been a great conversation. You have definitely a lot of good ideas. And so thank you very much. I'm definitely going to have you back next time when we talk about talent and candidate experience. So again, thanks for joining today and look forward to our next chat.
No, absolutely. It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.